Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, we need to clear up something right from the beginning as we launch into this fifth episode of our Seven Deadly Sins series and start talking about anger, that no doubt, anger doesn't have to be a sin, does it? I mean, if you're a Christian, you'll know that Jesus got angry. Remember that famous knocking over of the tables in the temple when he saw it being treated like a marketplace? Just imagine Martin Luther King Jr. not getting angry about injustice and inequality. Imagine what history would be if he hadn't gotten angry. So certainly anger can be a good thing, but the majority of us know that it can also be very misdirected, very self-centered, and certainly very misused, and it can cause a lot of harm. So we need to unravel what this anger thing is. What is the good side of it? What is the vice side of it? With Rebecca Conyndike de Young, philosopher and author of Glittering Vices, a new look at the seven deadly sins and their remedies. Hi, Rebecca. Good to talk to you again.
Good. Thanks for having me on the program.
Let's just clarify that, because in the tradition, and you've talked about this tradition over the last few weeks, you know, this tradition of spiritual writers like Thomas Aquinas and John Cassian and all of those, Augustine, all of those that have reflected on vice and virtue, there is a delineation between good anger and bad anger, isn't there?
There certainly is. In fact, it was a very vexed question for quite a while, especially early when this tradition originated in the 4th century in the deserts of Egypt with a couple of folks who lived a solitary ascetic existence in the desert. So they would withdraw into the desert and practice contemplative prayer and try to discipline them, engage in ascetic disciplines or spiritual disciplines that would purge them of the vices. And it was their consensus, actually, that all anger was bad. There was no right or righteous way to be angry. And Cassian puts it very, very strongly. He says, it doesn't matter whether you put gold in front of your eyes or lead in front of your eyes. No matter how precious the metal, the result is you can't see. So his idea was, no matter how noble the cause of your anger or ignoble the cause, the point is anger is going to blind you and make you incapable of prayer. And the only exception they made for that was being angry at your own sin or the demons who tempted you to sin. So the only anger was directed at immorality or its causes. No anger at another person was ever justified. And when you read that, you think, these people were really off the deep end. What's going on here? You know, where are the moderates? Well, they showed up a few centuries later, is the answer. And so the very first question that Thomas Aquinas addresses now in the 13th century is he has to ask the question, is all anger sinful? And his answer is no. And he takes, obviously, biblical precedent for that. He thinks that Jesus, as a human being, experienced the full complement of allowable human passions, good human passions, and anger is one of them. Jesus very clearly gets angry at a couple points. Perhaps not when you would expect him to, not on the cross, for example. But he's definitely experiencing anger. So we've got to find a way then to conceptualize the right kind of anger from the wrong kind of anger.
So where did he go then? How did he define the right from the wrong?
Well, he said there are two things you have to consider. First of all, what you're angry about. So you have to figure out what the object of your anger is. And he says if it's good anger, it's going to have a just cause. So most anger is directed at righting a wrong, correcting an injustice, or working for a justice that hasn't yet come to fruition. If it's bad anger, it's going to be selfishness that's your object. You know, you're after sort of your own, meeting your own agenda or your own expectations, regardless of whether that tramples on other people or not. And so the object of your anger is the first criterion. The second thing you have to think about is how you express your anger. So you might have the most just cause in the world, but if you are, you know, leaving a tornado in your path and using excessive violence to achieve your ends, not only will you probably fail to achieve justice, but your anger will have been out of proportion in its expression. So you have to have the way you express your anger be constructive, be proportionate to what you're angry about, and it has to be necessary for reestablishing justice. So there are some cases in which you can achieve justice better without anger, And there are some cases in which to address an injustice properly requires that you get angry about it, and you have to be very careful about distinguishing those cases.
Mm-hmm.
But in wrathful cases, the anger is completely disproportionate, it's ineffective, or it's unnecessary.
Yes.
And so how it's expressed is at least as much a part of the puzzle as what you're getting angry about.
Yes. This is Open House Across the Nation. Rebecca Kanine-Dyke DeYoung is our guide through the seven deadly sins and their remedies. She's the author of this book, Glittering Vices. We're talking about anger tonight, 1-300-40-2020 for your comments and your reflections after what you're hearing her say. So good anger addresses injustice. Bad anger is just to let off steam, normally for some sort of selfish cause. Technically, you can still actually be, it's okay to feel anger about an injustice that's done towards you as well, can't you?
Absolutely. And I think that's an important place to be angry, because part of what the emotion of anger does for us is serves a protective function. And there are times when the self needs protecting as well as other people need protecting. It's a way of kind of keeping a healthy boundary between yourself and other and warding off injury or correcting it when it comes.
Okay, now let's talk about the causes of anger. What might actually be, you know, behind some of the anger? I mean, obviously injustice when it comes to the good side. Martin Luther King Jr. is certainly a good example of that. Jesus overturning the money changers in the temple is a good example of that. What else might be behind some of our maybe wrong-sided anger?
I think there's a sense of how important we are in the universe. And sometimes that's a pretty inflated sense of our own ego or our own importance or the importance of our agenda or what we think we're entitled to. And when that gets threatened, anger rises to the fore. So you have to first of all start with what you care most about, what's most important to you. And that will, those things will be your hot button triggers. And I find that in many cases, at least in my own case and in the cases of, for example, the film examples that I use and so on, a lot of what's at stake is our sense of our reputation and respect in the eyes of others.
Mm-hmm.
So when we feel disrespected, that slight to our person is the at least as much of an occasion of anger as, for example, a physical injury would be. So when I talk about the movie The Mission, there's a wounded reputation that ends up in a murder. There's no physical injury done, but the injustice is solely to what the person thinks they're entitled to in terms of respect and deference to their character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really big deal to most people. If you feel like your very self-worth is being attacked, that's a vulnerable place. And it's a place that we'll pretty viciously defend ourselves when provoked.
Yeah. Now, that takes me back to what you've said before about the root of all of these vices is the root of pride. Is there anything, is that going too harsh, though, when it comes to that last one, kind of protecting your sense of self?
Well, it depends whether the self that you have in mind is an overinflated self that is cranked itself up a few more notches in the universe than it really deserves. I mean, anger, because it's so closely tied to justice, this has to be a just sense of who we are and what we're entitled to, and it has to be a just appraisal of of our worth. And you find that the angry person, there's a passage or a quotation on the American Psychological Association website that kind of sums this up. They say the underlying message of highly angry people is things have to go my way. Angry people tend to feel like if you block or change their plans, this is an unbearable indignity. Mm. It's a terrible affront.
Mm.
And it's very clear that they've got an overly puffed up sense of who they are, how important they are, and the idea that everyone else needs to sort of kowtow to their expectations or they're going to start blowing off some steam.
Yeah. 1-300-40-2020, if you've had an experience like that and you've learned from it, I'd love to hear your story. Does it resonate, the fact that actually it could be caused simply by just always wanting to have your way? Love to hear your comments too. 1-300-40-2020, you're listening to Open House, and philosopher Rebecca Kanine-Dyke DeYoung is with us as we walk our way through these seven deadly sins tonight, looking at anger. Let's talk about Jesus. I recently was reading through the Gospel of Mark. I was just touched by one particular moment in Jesus' life. He's in a synagogue. He calls forth somebody from the congregation to come up to the front. They've got a withered hand, and he asks the congregation, in particular the religious leaders, he says to them, is it good to do good on the Sabbath or not? To heal, you know, or to save on the Sabbath. And of course, those that were kind of against him were keeping their mouth shut. And it actually says that he got angry, but he also got sad. There was kind of this compassionate anger about what he felt there. It wasn't just anger, it wasn't just wrath. It was actually a certain degree of compassion towards those very people who were opposing him. That says a lot to me about how we actually handle anger. I get angry about a number of things, but I'm not too sure how many people I'm feeling both anger and also compassion over.
Yeah, Aquinas says about all the passions that they're rooted in love. So the way to analyze what you get angry about and why, and what you're fearful about and why, and what you take pleasure in and why, really has to do with what you care about most. And with respect to anger, Jesus' example here is such a beautiful picture of righteous anger, because he gets angry, but his anger is frustration at the religious leaders' unwillingness to be compassionate toward this person who's experiencing suffering. And so it's just a kind of grieving at their hard-heartedness and thinking, and as a parent, I think I can relate to the way Jesus feels, because when your children are fighting and hurting each other, you care about both children, and it hurts to see them hurting each other. And so your response is to be angry at the injury done, because you care about both of them. You don't want the one person to be an injurer, and you don't want the other person to be injured. And so you can see the damage being done to both of them. And it's so striking, especially in Mark's gospel, that he would describe Jesus' inner state at all. Mark is such a pithy action writer. But he stops and he talks about the way that Jesus feels about the situation, I think because it reveals the heart of God. When God sees people getting angry in a bad way at each other, he's grieved for the damage being done to the one injuring and grieved at the one being injured. And that's what provokes his anger. It's interesting that when Jesus turns over the tables, the gospel writer will describe Jesus as zealous for the Lord, quoting the prophet, but doesn't actually describe Jesus in terms of this internal state of anger. But in Mark, in this particular passage, which I absolutely love, he does describe Jesus' inner state as being angry. And if you think about the way Jesus handled that, again, the object of anger is to make things right.
Yes.
To redress a wrong. And so what does Jesus do when they won't answer him? He says, what should I heal the man or should I not heal the man? What do you think I should do? And they won't even answer him. So the coldness of their response is just, it's unnerving and it's infuriating. And so what does Jesus do? Does he give him the smackdown? Does he slap him in the face and say, shake out of your hard-heartedness, people? He doesn't do anything to them. What he does is he heals the man, and it's such a powerful witness of, okay, there's something wrong here, and if you won't do anything to be a part of the solution, then I will show you what compassion and love looks like, and I hope that that will then break through your hard-heartedness. But of course, the end of the passage is they go out and plot how to kill him.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think the character of God is such an important part of this conversation too. There's this caricature of the God of the Old Testament as this great God of wrath, as if that's the only quality he actually has. We could unpack that for another hour, I'm sure. But the fact is, over and over again, starting in the book of Exodus, but then in the book of Jonah and the Psalms and a whole bunch of other places throughout the Old Testament, we actually hear God is slow to anger, abounding in love. He doesn't just simply, at the drop of a hat when we do something wrong, get absolutely furious. He is slow to anger. I think that has to be brought into the conversation too.
It certainly does. And this is actually an exercise I give to my students. And I say, you do have this perception of, the wrath of the Lord. And, if you read enough of the minor prophets, you're definitely going to get a sense that, when people oppress the poor, God's going to be, he's going to feel for the poor enough to step in and do some people out for it.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that's exactly the right response he would expect from us as well. But when they go through and they do passage after passage after passage, there are at least 12 that I know about, the idea that if you're a, you know, we very rarely read the whole Old Testament in one fell swoop, much less in a year. But if you read through it, you do get the sense of this refrain coming through Scripture, that God is slow to anger, he's patient. Mm. And then when you read the book of Proverbs, most of the Proverbs about anger will warn you about being a hothead, being too quick to anger. Hmm. So the question is, what's the scriptural advice here? I mean, and the general tenor is, love is the dominant mode of approaching other people. And so when there's injury done, what you first have to do is not jump in with anger, but to assess the situation, to figure out how to best work for restorative justice. And then if anger helps that cause, to mobilize all the passions, anger and all the rest of them, to help you serve justice. That's a tall order.
Yeah.
Let me just say, I love Aquinas' view that anger can be a good thing, that there can be righteous anger. I think it's the right view because it's consonant with Scripture. But in practice, I'm with the Desert Fathers. I think if I went through my life and I counted up how many occasions of righteous anger there were, I could probably count them on one hand. So as a matter of sort of practical application, the Desert Fathers' advice to get rid of all anger might not be bad advice most of us. I'm speaking for myself, but I'm just wondering if that could be generalized.
I'm with you. I think that the weight of focus needs to be there. So take us there then. Just give us some pointers as to how we can kind of, you know, start working on rooting out that wrong kind of anger out of our lives.
Some really practical, I think, psychological advice here, too, given all the work that's been done on anger in that profession. And here, I think, a timeout or a stepping back from the situation to evaluate the cause of your anger is a really good discipline. And one of the reasons that we need to step back from anger is because we know from experience that most of the time we get angry, the anger is going to be disproportionate or it's going to be slightly misdirected. It's not going to be pure and holy right off the bat. Mm. And so if you know that about yourself, when you get angry, to do the double check is always a very useful tool. One of the things that the tradition says about anger is that it has these offspring vices, the things that if you have sort of a wrathful disposition, these are the sorts of patterns you see showing up in your life. And one of them, they call it swelling of the mind, and it's such a lovely medieval term. But what they mean is running the tapes over and over and over in your head and dwelling on the offense and magnifying it and telling the story over and over again and embellishing it every time. So by the time you're done telling the story to yourself or someone else for the 10th time, the person who's injured you comes off as the worst possible criminal ever, which will justify any manner of revenge that you have in mind. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What do you need to do at that point? Step out.
Absolutely.
Step back. Time out. Stop. You need to do something to kind of clear your head and come back to assess the situation. Mm. So one of the exercises I give my students to help them do this and to help see them see patterns of anger in their life, because that's what we're dealing with the vices, is I have them document every single time they get angry for a week. So they have to tell me then what they got angry about, and then they have to rate how angry they were on a scale of 1 to 5. And if you, when you're describing what you were angry about, if you feel the need to write 2 pages, that alone should give you a 5 in the intensity of anger column. You're way too angry about this. So you write this all down in a journal, and you just do it for a week, and then you shut the journal and you put it away for a couple weeks. And then you come back to it later. And, boy, a month later, things sure look differently. Wow, I was just completely obsessed with this situation, and I was completely over the top with it. And I can see now that I was just tired, and I had too many things going on, and I had several crushing deadlines, and this was the outlet for all that frustration about something else. So the anger wasn't actually about what I thought it was about. It was coming from somewhere else. And it's only the kind of stepping back and reflective self-examination that can help you see what your anger triggers typically are and see what sort of things that you're getting angry about and evaluate whether those are good or bad.
Yeah. All right, let's tackle gluttony this time next week. Thanks again, Rebecca. So fascinating to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Rebecca Canine-Dyke DeYoung, author of Glittering Vices, a new look at the seven deadly sins and their remedies, and our guide to the seven deadly sins and how to overcome them.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast, thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.